From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Edmund White has been chronicling gay life for over two decades. He's also the author of a biography of the French writer Jean Genet, which won a National Book Award last year. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Ed White reflects on the recent loss of his lover to AIDS. Also today, we talk with linguist Deborah Tannen. Her best-selling book, You Just Don't Understand, examined the problems men and women have talking with each other. Now Tannen has a new book that explores how those differences affect who gets heard at work. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the latest kids show to come from Jim Henson Productions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. North Carolina Senator Republican Jesse Helms says he regrets a remark quoted by a North Carolina newspaper. Helms told the Raleigh News and Observer that President Clinton better have a bodyguard if he visits military bases in North Carolina because he's so unpopular. But today, Helms says he wasn't speaking literally and that the off-the-cuff remark should never have been printed. The incoming chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Republican Henry Hyde, says his panel will consider a school prayer amendment next year. But a coalition of religious groups is urging the new Republican leadership not to legislate school prayer. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The groups, including the United Methodist Church, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Presbyterian Church, USA, contend that children already have the right to voluntary prayer in school. During a news conference on the steps of the Supreme Court, Brent Walker with the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs warned that a school prayer amendment would politicize and trivialize prayer.
We oppose it not because we're against prayer, we're very much in favor of prayer, but precisely for that reason, we don't want government interfering with it or meddling in it. When government tries to do that, they always foul things up.
The incoming Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, told Republican governors today that he doesn't believe Congress should mandate prayer, but he says students who do want to pray shouldn't be punished for it. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The leaders of the new Republican-controlled Congress promised today to work with GOP governors to implement reforms and decentralize government. Senate Republican leader Bob Dole told the governors, "We can make a difference if we work together." 30 Republican governors and governors-elect are attending the three-day meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia. President Clinton today welcomed Ukrainian President Leonid Kuchma to the White House in an elaborate ceremony. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Ukrainian President Kuchma received a warm welcome from Mr. Clinton, who offered him a variety of expressions of support. Some of them were political and symbolic.
America will stand with you to support your independence, your territorial integrity, and your reforms. We are bound together by a dedication to peace and a devotion to freedom.
And some were of a more practical economic nature. Kuchma had come here looking for more U.S. aid, and senior administration officials briefing reporters say he'll get it, to the tune of another $100 million. Bill Small at the White House.
The U.N. says Serb forces are continuing their assault on the northwestern Bosnian town of Bihać despite NATO airstrikes yesterday. And a top Bosnian Serb general says he can no longer guarantee the safety of U.N. peacekeeping troops in Bosnia. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 85 points at 36.84. Trading is heavy. This is NPR News in Washington. Researchers say they have isolated a genetic defect which may trigger prostate cancer. Doctors at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore say the genetic change appeared in the bodies of all the prostate victims they studied, but was not found in the tissue of healthy men. They say the discovery may lead to early identification of prostate cancer victims. The federal government says there's not yet enough scientific evidence to determine if portable cellular telephones present any health risks to humans. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Research conducted by the General Accounting Office, Congress's investigative arm, has failed to find a direct link between portable cellular telephones and any adverse health effects. The GAO says no research has been completed on long-term human exposure to low levels of radiation, specifically from portable cell phones. The agency also says the research has been inconclusive, with some studies showing biological effects from extended exposure while others did not. Unlike car phones or cordless phones, portable cellular phone antenna are close to a user's head, and that has raised questions about a potential link to brain cancer and other health concerns. The GAO says 16 million Americans already use cell phones and cited industry estimates that more than 60 million people will use them by the year 2000. Congressman Edward Markey of Massachusetts is chairman of the House Telecommunications Subcommittee. He says the report highlights the need for further research. Markey is urging the White House to coordinate policy among government agencies to provide the scientific answers needed. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
OPEC oil ministers have decided to freeze their oil production for the next 12 months. Industry analysts say it's an attempt to force the price of crude oil to rise over the coming year. Crude oil is now selling for about $16 a barrel, and OPEC would like to get $21. Some experts say the price could go even higher if Iraq fails to convince the UN to raise sanctions against its oil. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ed White has chronicled gay culture for over two decades in his fiction and nonfiction. He knew he was gay when he was 12, but he was so guilt-struck, he spent 7 years going to psychiatrists hoping to be cured. He was at the Stonewall Bar the night of the 1969 Stonewall Uprising, which marks the beginning of the gay rights movement. That night also marked a turning point in White's life. His essays are collected in the new book, The Burning Library. They begin in 1969 and end deep in the AIDS era. White is HIV positive. Last year, White won a National Book Award for his biography of the French writer Jean Genet. It's just been published in paperback. White lives in Paris now. I spoke with him last month during his brief trip to the States and asked him to read an excerpt from his forthcoming collection of short stories called Skinned Alive. This is from a story called Watermarked about first love.
Our love worked well because Randall was the one man in 1,000 who welcomed devotion and who, like a medieval princess, believed in it only after it had been proved by many deeds and long trials. Most men like chasing after rather than being the quarry and flee someone too obviously in love. Being adored suffocates and gives them too little imaginative scope. Only someone unobtainable leaves enough room for dreams, inspires longing, promotes scheming, and implies a rival, whereas a quick and total conquest is the last act that abrogates all need for the preceding drama. But Randall had had enough strife at home and wanted to be cherished. I so enjoyed serving him and supporting him and listening to him that I forgot my own existence, certainly my own uninteresting face. If I would glance at my own reflection after a long evening spent with him, I'd be offended by the reminder that such sustained communion hadn't improved my looks. I learned what a burden beauty can be. Drunk men at parties would take an instant dislike to Randall. Eventually I figured out their reasoning. I want him. He thinks he's too good for me. The bastard. He didn't want to be liked merely for his looks, but he needed to maintain them just in case.
You know, I was thinking, reading this story about a first love, about whether, you know, when you're talking about looks and what, you know, whether men like to be the pursuer or the pursued. And I was thinking if those kinds of things are much different when the relationship is gay than it is from when it's straight. You know, I was identifying with you. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I think that, I mean, some people say that the burden of being a gay man is that you're supposed to be as successful as a man and as beautiful as a woman. Mm. I mean, in other words, you have to play both roles and, or ideally, you're expected to. And I think a lot of gay men feel under tremendous pressure to be both successful and attractive, and it's awfully hard to be either one, but certainly to be both is rare.
You know, in the beginning of this story, you write about learning to be gay, learning certain behaviors, learning to dish,
right,
and then teaching it to others. Were there aspects of gay culture that you felt you actually learned?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a difference between being homosexual and being gay. I mean, I think homosexual is simply a question of desire for a certain kind of sexual encounter with members of your own sex. But being gay implies a whole culture, a whole way of acting, of thinking, and it changes, of course, from decade to decade. In in the case of this story, I talk about someone who's coming out in the late 1950s and who's learning from Chicago street queens how to camp and how to dish and how to... I mean, it's the sort of thing that I guess we know about now from drag queens, but that then in those days was more generally acceptable in gay society.
As you've gotten older, how has your idea of the ideal companion changed?
Well, I think that I now prize real intimacy more than I did before. Perhaps I didn't even know what it was. I mean, I lost my lover to AIDS this last March, and his name was Hubert. He was French. I was with him for 5 years. And I think that in my own case, I was always afraid of intimacy with people. But when you live with someone, I mean, the last 4 of the 5 years that we were together, we knew that he had AIDS and didn't have long to live. And when you know, when you're living with somebody that you know is not going to live very long, you give up all your fears about guarding your independence, and you just give yourself completely to somebody, just as I feel that he gave himself to me. I mean, he had been married when I met him, and he gave up his wife, his language, his country, his job, to come with me when I was coming to Providence to teach at Brown University in 1990. And so I felt like he had made a total gift of himself to me, and that's what I wanted to be able to give to him. But I think before that, I had never really understood that kind of gift. I mean, I hear people today talk about codependency as though it's a bad thing, but I think, in fact, that's what love is. Love is codependency. It's perfectly okay to be codependent.
Did you take care of him at the end when he was there?
Yes, I was with him in Morocco. We had been there in January, and he liked it so much because of the warm weather, and he wanted to go back, so we went back in March, even though everyone advised us against it. And he wanted to see the desert before he died. It was really a very romantic death in a way, but also very harrowing, especially for me. So we did get to Erfoud, which is in the southeastern corner of Morocco, in the Sahara. And there he began to go, and I drove feverishly to get us back to a hospital and hopefully to a plane that would take us back to Paris. And I had made all the arrangements for a medical repatriation. But in fact, he died in Marrakesh before he could get back. And then I had to make all those ghastly arrangements for the repatriation of the body, which is a very complicated thing to do in a Muslim country when you're sending the body to a Christian country.
Oh, gosh, who wants to be stuck with administrative work after the person you love most in the world is gone?
Well, the funny thing is that he was he had been an architect when I met him, and then he had to quit architecture because he wasn't well enough to do it. And then he turned himself into an illustrator, and we did a book together called Sketches from Memory, which is going to come out next year. And it's his illustrations in my texts about our area in Paris, where we lived in the very heart of Paris, the Châtelet area. And it's just sort of little, very funny little glimpses, I hope they're funny, of the people, like the concierge and the Cambodian man who runs the delicatessen across the way, who also writes poetry and who's, in fact, Cambodia's most famous poet. And, so it was really just little sketches of people. And he was determined to finish this book, and he did finish it just 1 week before he died. And when he was dying in Morocco, he said to me, "I wish you would write an introduction explaining who I was and how I wrote this book." So on the plane coming back from Morocco, I mean, he died that morning, and on the very day that he died, I think I realized I really must be a writer, because it's the only thing I know to do when I'm this unhappy and afraid of really going crazy. I was afraid if I started sobbing too much, they wouldn't let me on the plane or something, and I had to get back to make the funeral arrangements. So anyway, there I was on the plane, feverishly writing away, and I finished the introduction just as we came into Paris.
Throughout your career as a writer, you've written about relationships and about being gay. And you have a new book that collects your essays from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And there's something that you wrote in a 1977 essay called The Joys of Gay Life about relationships that I'd like you to read for us.
Sure, with pleasure. One of the things we are forced to re-examine is relationships. Unlike straight people, we do not have church weddings. We are not often enrolled in the PTA. We are not clear on who is the breadwinner and who is the homemaker. We don't have relatives clucking over us, urging us to be faithful and fertile and upstanding. Our relationships have little social or legal reality. As a result, we must invent love all over again.
I'm wondering the different ways you feel you've invented love. You know, if you feel like you've invented it and reinvented it over the years as things have changed.
Well, yes, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think that probably originally, as this story Watermarked reveals, one of my images probably for love was something like the gentleman who's in love with a dancer at the ballet or something like that. I mean, I was the guy who wasn't so great looking but who was very ardent, and the other person, the person I was in love with, tended to be somebody extraordinarily beautiful. And I've written quite a bit about physical beauty. And I know that some of my gay critics have accused me of looksism, which is supposed to be a very bad thing. But I think, of course, most artists are probably sensitive to beauty in all of its forms. But for me, I think it was part of my own inferiority complex that I, not just because I felt I was quite average looking, but also because I felt inferior as a gay man. And I needed to have this terribly flashy beauty on my arm to reassure myself that I was okay. And as a consequence, I learned a lot about what it must be like to be beautiful and to have all the problems and advantages of being extraordinarily beautiful. But I think over the years, that notion changed. I mean, maybe because I became more sure of myself, but I'm not at all indifferent to physical beauty, but it's not very high on my priority list anymore. I think what I like most now is tenderness, a reciprocal love, shared interests, and I think tenderness is really the word.
If this isn't too personal, has your idea of monogamy changed over the years, of the relative importance or unimportance of it?
I've never believed that people should try to be monogamous. I think there's something slightly dispiriting and kind of lower middle class about the idea of wanting to, I mean, sort of suburban about wanting to be faithful. I mean, with Hubert, my last lover, I was faithful. Even when he was too ill to have sex and we didn't have sex anymore, I was still faithful to him because it's what I wanted to be. It didn't occur to me to be any way else. I think when you feel drawn to the other person to such an extent, and you have such a trust with the other person that monogamy is inevitable, well, then I think it's perfectly okay. But as an ideal, I don't hold it up.
My guest is Ed White. He has a new collection of essays called The Burning Library. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Ed White. In your new collection of essays, The Burning Library, you write about the first time you saw one of the backroom bars of Greenwich Village in 1970, and this was shortly after you got back to the village after living in Rome for close to a year. What was your reaction when you first saw that?
I thought it was a little bit scary, but also terrific. I mean, it seemed to me that, I mean, now that because of AIDS, we all tend to act as though there was something abnormal and distressing and inevitably sinful about that period of promiscuity. And even the word promiscuity, of course, is one that is loaded against the people who practice it. But I think that I think it was Susan Sontag once who said that there was only a very brief period for both men and women, both gays and straights, when they weren't When they were able to be sexually free, and basically it's something that started with sexual freedom started with the invention of antibiotics and later the birth control pill and ended with AIDS. So in other words, let's say there's a period of 15 or 20 years when in all of human history, when people had all the necessary conditions, which include the anonymity of living in a big city, the breakdown of traditional religion, the freedom from venereal disease, the freedom from becoming pregnant through sex, when people could actually practice sex as a form of self-expression, as a form of art, as a form of pleasure, rather than as a form of economic exchange or all the other things that sex has been harnessed into serving.
And you're grateful that you had a chance to experience that period.
I would say yes, and I think a lot of people who lived through that period and enjoyed it thoroughly are now betraying it by condemning it. But that's just part of the new fashionable Puritanism, which I don't approve of at all.
I want to read an excerpt from an essay you wrote in 1983 that was originally published in Vanity Fair called Sexual Culture. And you were writing, "No homosexual can take his homosexuality for granted. He must sound it, palpate it. For that reason, all homosexuals are, quote, gay philosophers and that they must invent themselves." And then you wrote, "On the other hand, no straight man stands in rapt contemplation of his straightness unless he's an ass." And I guess, you know, like so much of your life has been given over to writing about being gay, both in your essays, in your autobiographies, in your fiction.
You know, I have the strange feeling that writing itself is somehow linked to homosexuality. I haven't worked this out, so I won't be able to make any sense of it. But I think it's really very odd if you think of it that now Time magazine tells us this week that only 1.5% of people are gay. So if that's true, think how very, very few homosexuals there actually are. And yet, if you look at the famous writers of this century, I mean, a huge high proportion of them are gay. And it seems to me that there is something that about writing itself, which is a way of at once participating in society, but also looking at it from an enormous distance, of at once imitating the conventions of society while having a very jaundiced eye toward them. It seems to me that spirit which animates the work of homosexual writers like Proust, for instance, or Gide, or Jean Genet, it seems to me that there is something fundamental. I mean, in other words, something about being gay means that you pass or can pass as an ordinary member of society, and yet you always feel different. You always feel that you're of this other race. So it's a bit, I suppose, like a black person who looks white or a Jew who doesn't look Jewish, who is passing as a Gentile or as a white person or in the case of a homosexual, as a heterosexual. In other words, you're a kind of double agent and you're living a different kind of life from the one you feel inside. And so I think when I keep talking in these essays about the need of gay people to invent themselves, it's also, I think, that they have a need for seeing through the conventions of ordinary society.
So you think part of the reason why you became a writer was the sense of being the double agent?
Definitely. I think when I first began writing, it was like a kind of a desperate attempt to fight off the waves of self-hatred and guilt that I think were really threatening my sanity. I mean, when I was 14 or 15 years old, a psychiatrist told my mother that I should be put in a mental hospital and they should just throw the key away, that I was unsalvageable. And I certainly was, I think, right on the edge of a mental collapse. And the one thing that saved me was writing. And I went to a boarding school, and I would do all my homework in the afternoon so that at night during study hall, all I would have to do for those 2 hours was work on my novel. So I had already finished a novel by the time I was 15, another one by the time I was 17. And I didn't write in a kind of arty way. I was writing out of a real desperate need to make sense of the world, to fight off this madness.
Let me just backtrack for a second here. I think I know what you mean, but why would a straight person who stands in rapt contemplation of his heterosexuality be an ass?
Well, it'd be like a white person sort of looking at his own body and saying, oh, aren't I beautiful? I'm all white. I mean, you would just say, what a nitwit, you know. Whereas a black person who says black is beautiful, you can understand that, because since the dominant society did, at least until 20 or 30 years ago, find the state of being black inferior. And little black girls back in those days used to buy white dolls. To say black is beautiful was a revolutionary statement. To say white is beautiful is idiotic.
So it's about contemplating your difference.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, I think if you're coming from a persecuted minority, you need to redefine yourself, not in the terms of the dominant society, but in your own terms, in new terms that will empower you or enfranchise you. Whereas if you are already a member of the dominant society, to simply glory in being dominant is fatuous.
In one of your essays, you write that although at some point in your career, you started writing for what you perceived as a sophisticated gay reader. Earlier on, as a writer, you saw your audience as an older European heterosexual woman.
Yes.
Well, who was this idealized reader, and why?
Well, I think it was Mrs. Nabokov. And because, and she actually would read my writing. And when I finally met her years later, after her husband had died, I went to the Montreux Palace Hotel in Switzerland and met her. And she was already quite deaf, and she did that thing that deaf people oftentimes do of just doing all the talking, because that way they don't have to hear what you have to say. But I didn't mind, because she also did the thing that every writer dreams of another person doing. She recited pages of my first novel, Forgetting Elena, by heart, because she, in fact, had a photographic memory. And she could just summon up whole pages of one's prose and recite them. And to have the woman to whom Nabokov dedicated every one of his novels and the muse of the greatest writer of the century recite to you whole pages of your own work was, of course, the most delicious thrill imaginable. So, but long before that, before I ever knew her, but when I knew that, in fact, she was reading my writing because she would write me notes about it, I did have her as a kind of ideal reader, and not just because I admired her husband and her and them as a couple, but also because it seemed to me like a filter to make sure that, I mean, one of the things that I sometimes don't like about contemporary gay writing is that I feel that it makes a lot of inside references that make it accessible only to other gay people. And one of the things I wanted to try to do was to write about gay experience from the inside and in a fairly sophisticated way, without any hint of apology, and yet in a way that would be totally accessible to people who weren't gay. And I don't know, I mean, once a heterosexual man in England said to me that he never had thought he'd had a single homosexual thought in his whole life, but that he had found himself getting very excited once reading one of my sex scenes between two men. And that thrilled me, not because I had managed to excite this particular man, but who wasn't one of my dream people, but just the idea that I had been able to communicate what that kind of desire would be like to somebody who wasn't cut out for it at all.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, as I always do.
Ed White's new collection of essays is called The Burning Library. His biography of Jean Genet has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Deborah Tannen's best-selling book, You Just Don't Understand, confirmed what a lot of people already knew, that men and women talk differently. Now Tannen has narrowed her focus, looking at how gender differences in conversational style affect what goes on at the office. Coming up, Deborah Tannen explains how men and women talk 9 to 5. Also, TV critic David Bianculli introduces us to his new favorite talk show hosts, a polar bear named Jake and a skunk named Stinky. They're the co-hosts of the latest kids show to come out of the Jim Henson Studios. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Despite yesterday's NATO airstrikes on an airfield in Croatia used by the Serbs to attack the Muslim enclave of Bihać, fierce fighting has continued for control of the area. Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has angrily reacted to yesterday's NATO action. The BBC's Jim Muir reports.
Mr. Karadzic described the NATO attack as a criminal act by a criminal organization. He said that retaliation was being considered and that it would be painful for the NATO nations. Despite his dire warnings and similar remarks from his army commander, General Mladic, United Nations forces on the ground have so far encountered no unusual problems. It's business as usual, and they've dropped back to a normal level of alert. But the NATO airstrike has apparently had no effect at all in diminishing the intensity of the ground battle for the Bihać enclave. In fact, by all accounts, the fighting has escalated. Hundreds of civilians have been displaced as a string of villages was attacked and devastated. The International Red Cross said that 70% of the houses in one village had been destroyed and that 2,000 people have taken refuge in Bihać.
Jim Muir reporting from Sarajevo. A hostage situation is underway at this hour at police headquarters in Washington, D.C. A man is reportedly holding at least one hostage after shooting several people about an hour ago. News reports say at least one policeman has been killed and several people were wounded. A Geneva-based human rights group says Japan should pay compensation to thousands of women forced into brothels for Japanese soldiers during World War II. NPR's Jillie McCarthy has more from Tokyo.
The human rights group concluded the wartime policy that forced at least 100,000 women into virtual sex slavery requires Japan to compensate its victims 50 years after the fact with $40,000 cash payments. The systematic brutality against the women, mostly from Korea, the Philippines, and China, amounted to war crimes, said the panel. Its report, based on interviews with dozens of survivors, documents Tokyo's role in entrapping and transporting women, some of whom were as young as 13. The group also criticized the Allies for failing to pursue the issue after the war. Though anxious to make amends with its Asian neighbors as the 50th anniversary of the war's end nears, Japan has refused reparations for fear of setting a costly precedent. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
On Wall Street, stocks closed sharply lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 91.52 points to close the day at 3677.99. Declining issues led advances by a 4-to-1 margin. Trading today was heavy. So far, 383 million shares changed hands. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington. Wendy's International says it's told its 4,300 restaurants to stop selling hot chocolate until it can figure out a way to cool down the beverage. A Wendy's spokesman says most of the people buying hot chocolate are children, and it's not responsible to put a 180-degree drink into the hands of a child. Wendy's decision follows a multi-million-dollar jury award to a New Mexico woman who was burned after spilling a cup of McDonald's coffee. That was later reduced to $480,000. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi today vowed he will not step down, despite being placed under investigation for corruption. NPR's Silvia Pagioli has more from Rome.
In a long statement videotaped for the TV nightly news, Berlusconi said he had never corrupted anyone, and only a clear and explicit vote of no confidence in Parliament would force him to resign. The TV tycoon turned prime minister was informed he's on a magistrate's list as a corruption suspect. The warning does not imply guilt, but informs the recipient that prosecutors have sufficient evidence to open a probe. The prime minister's brother and other executives of Berlusconi's conglomerate have already admitted paying bribes to tax auditors, but the prime minister has said the payments were extorted by corrupt officials. In his toughly worded statement, Berlusconi said he would resist what he called an infamous abuse of justice. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
A judge has ruled that hundreds of Haitian children living in U.S. tent camps at Guantanamo Bay should be allowed to enter the United States. The judge says the 230 Haitian children should be granted the same treatment as the Clinton administration has given to Cuban children. The government is expected to appeal. The ceasefire in Angola's civil war got off to a shaky start today, with both the government and UNITA rebels accusing the other side of violating the truce. But officials say fighting appeared to subside a few hours after the truce began. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Here's a question for women. When you make a suggestion at work, do you often preface it with a disclaimer, like, "You've probably already thought of this, but," or, "I don't know if this will work, but"? According to Deborah Tannen, that's typical of women who like to downplay their authority, soften their criticisms, and seek consensus. But men often misunderstand this woman talk and interpret it as insecurity or discomfort with authority. Tannen says the differences between the conversational styles of men and women lead to constant misunderstandings at work. She analyzes why in her new book, Talking from 9 to 5. Tannen is a linguist who also explored the differences between how men and women speak in her best-selling book, You Just Don't Understand. She opens her new book with an example of one typical misunderstanding at work. Donald has just submitted a woefully inadequate report to his supervisor, Amy, and she has to tell him the report has to be redone.
In delivering the criticism, Amy thought the appropriate thing to do was start with praise, tell him everything that was good about it. And she was quite pleased with how it had gone because he seemed to take the criticism quite well. But then when she got the revision, he hadn't made any of the changes that she thought were necessary. When she confronted him about this, he said, but you told me it was fine. So he heard the praise as the main point. To her, the praise was the preamble to the criticism. And I believe that this results from their different expectations for how that conversation should go. In other words, he obviously expected that if it was basically inadequate, she would have said that up front. And she obviously thought that the best way to give criticism is to start by acknowledging everything that was good. I could assume that if their roles were reversed, she might be offended by someone who got right to the point and tore something apart without acknowledging what was good. And another thing about this that's very crucial is that it's quite common for ways of speaking that are quite common among women to take the other person's reaction into account. In other words, spend some time saving face for the other person. And so starting that criticism with praise is a way of saving face for him. Because he didn't expect it to come in this way, though, he missed the point.
Your point, I think, is that both styles are equally valid, but if you have people using different communication styles, they're always going to misunderstand each other.
Right, because conversation is fundamentally a ritual. In other words, we don't mean what we say literally any more than when you call somebody on the phone and ask, "Is Mary there?" You don't expect them to say yes and keep holding the phone, although children sometimes do that because they haven't learned the ritual. When we talk at work, have conversations, we talk in ways that seem self-evidently the way to speak. But if you talk to someone who doesn't share the ritual, then they're likely to interpret it literally. And that's where talk at work is sometimes more challenging to many women than to men, because so many of the conversational rituals that many women use take a one-down position or save face for the other person and therefore puts you in a somewhat vulnerable position, but we don't mean it literally. We expect the other person to realize it's just a ritual and bring us back up. An example is the one that comes up so often where women might say, "I'm sorry." And it doesn't mean an apology. It means, "I'm sorry that happened." For example, the teacher who had to send a difficult student to the principal and then later met the principal in the hall and learned that he had suspended the student and said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And he said, "Well, don't apologize. It's not your fault."
Well, you have a good I'm sorry story that you tell in the book, and this is something that actually happened to you. There was a journalist in your class observing the class when you used the word I'm sorry, and she interpreted it, or he interpreted it, differently than you'd intended. Tell us the story.
Right. Well, a journalist had turned up at a class that I teach unannounced and told me that she had tried to call me on the phone but hadn't reached me, and she wanted to sit into my class to observe. Now, I have a policy that I never allow people to observe because so many people want to, and it's really not fair to the students since I always teach my class as seminars. But confronted with someone who had gone out of her way to get there, I went ahead and let her in, which right away I think was probably accommodating more to her than perhaps I should have. In the class, some students had made some errors in what they had done for their assignments. And to save face for them, I said something like, "Well, maybe I wasn't clear in giving my instructions, but this is what you really were supposed to do." Now, I knew that I had been clear in the instructions, and most of the students knew. But this was a ritual way of not embarrassing the ones who had done the assignment wrong publicly. But the journalist used this in her article and said something like, "Here's this expert in communication. She can't even give clear instructions to her own students." And it just seemed to me typical of so many things I observed in my own research in the workplace, where women are less likely to be monitoring their way of speaking to make sure that they don't talk in a way that could make them look bad. They will often say things that could make them look bad, but they know they don't mean it literally, and they're depending on other people to realize that this is just a ritual.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Tannen, and she has a new book about gender misunderstandings in the workplace, and it's called Talking from 9 to 5. Do you think women are sometimes misunderstood when they're indirect in using their authority, and that they're interpreted as being insecure or unable to manage, and are therefore penalized?
Yes. I think women are seen as insecure and lacking in confidence more often than they really are. And on the other side, I think men are often seen as arrogant when they're simply speaking in ways that they have learned to speak in their growing up with boys, because boys are very hard on boys who leave themselves vulnerable in any way. And so they learn that they ought to talk in ways that create their status and cover up any weaknesses. Women, on the other hand, have grown up as girls, where the girls will be very hard on another girl who tells others what to do in too obvious a way. She'll be called bossy. Or if she talks about what she's good at in too obvious a way, they'll say she's stuck up or she really thinks she's something. So they learn that they should downplay what they're good at and just depend on other people to see that and appreciate it. Unfortunately, in the workplace, we have to worry not only about getting the work done, but about getting credit for what we do. And I observed in many situations where women were speaking in ways that were very good for getting the work done, but not as successful at getting credit for what they've done if they're talking to people who don't understand that ritual.
Well, this leads into another problem you point out, which is that you've found that women spend less time promoting themselves.
Yes, and this is a good time to make clear that I don't claim that all women and men talk the same way. So there are a lot of ethnic differences, regional differences that I talk about as well. But styles that are common among women often avoid anything that calls attention to oneself in an obvious way. So, for example, one woman I observed was saying "we" to talk about something that I knew she had done herself. And when I asked her why she was saying "we" instead of "I," she said, "Well, it would sound too self-promoting if I said I." Now, ideally, and I think in many situations, that's just fine because everybody was there and they knew who did what. But in a situation where you have to get credit not only from your immediate peers, but also from your boss and your boss's boss, they may not have been there to see who did what. I also heard a man, I'm thinking of one example, who was saying "we" about something that had come out of his team, but actually he had not done. And teamwork is very tricky this way. It's a style of work that many women feel comfortable in, that is being part of a group effort. But promotions and raises are not handed out on the team level. They're handed out to individuals. And so the challenge then is to communicate beyond the team who did what. And often the people who get credit for that are the ones who are either talking about it to the boss or even to the boss's boss, and they may be the ones who somehow get credit for what that team did.
Linguist Deborah Tannen is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is linguist Deborah Tannen. Her new book, Talking from 9 to 5, is about how differences between men and women's conversational styles cause misunderstandings at work. Have you found that women speak differently to other women on the job than they speak to other men?
Yes and no. I think women, when I observed women in groups of meetings that were just women, there were some ways they were talking differently. Interestingly, there was more laughter. There was more overlap. In other words, they talked along quite a bit, one talking along with the other, not as an interruption, but as a sign of enthusiasm. They mixed talk about work with talk about personal things, jokes about diet, jokes about clothing. When I observed women talking with men in meetings, some I could see them trying to do some of the same things, and it didn't always work as well. So I observed meetings where a woman was laughing, and the man she was talking to was not laughing along with her. And it left her, again, in a kind of vulnerable position where it almost looked like she was putting herself down because she was the only one laughing. Whereas when she laughed and the woman she was talking to laughed, then it didn't. It was not self-deprecating. So again, this is a pattern where if you try to do something in a ritual way and it's not understood ritually, it can put you in that one-down position.
Well, so how do you think women's styles sometimes can affect them during salary negotiations and title negotiations?
Well, the same things can come into play. One man told me that it was not unusual for women to come to him and say, I would like a raise because so-and-so is doing similar work and he makes more than me. Or I would like a raise because I really need it. My family is having these problems and we need more money. Both of these, he explained, were weak bargaining positions because he could point to someone who was making less money. So that took care of the first one, and whether she needs it is irrelevant to the company. He felt that it would be much more effective to come in and say, I want a raise because I am doing this job, this is effective, and this is helping the company in this way. And again, many women might resist doing that because it would seem self-promoting.
Are you making the argument that women or men need to change?
I don't say that anyone, women or men, needs to change. I don't say anyone, women or men, should never change. I see my role as making people aware of how conversation, how ways of talking, how language is a force in your life, so that each individual has the power and the control to decide whether something about their way of talking may be having an influence in their work lives that they're not happy with, and in that situation, whether they might want to try talking differently. It's especially tricky for women, though, because if we talk in ways that are associated with men or expected of men, we may get a very different reaction than a man talking the same way would get. It's interesting. One woman told me that she was accused by her boss of being not soft enough, not approachable enough. And she told me that she solved this problem. Now everything's fine. And I asked her for an example of how she had changed. And the example she gave me was that she had started saying, I'm sorry, more. And I like that example because it's so easy to hear the kind of thing I said and conclude that I must be telling women they should never say, I'm sorry. And that's not my point at all. It's to be aware of how ways of speaking could be affecting our interactions. So in some situations, I think women might want to stop saying I'm sorry if they feel they're not being appreciated, and they're the only ones saying, I'm sorry, and they realize that they're being taken literally. In other cases, I think men might benefit, or some women might benefit, from saying, I'm sorry, more often. It's something that can be very disarming to other people and make them much more willing to admit their fault and to accommodate, which I think is the spirit in which many women say, I'm sorry. It often is a way of making the other person more comfortable admitting their part in something.
Now, you've been on an interview tour, so you're not dealing with workplace language, but every day you're meeting people from the press, radio, television, newspapers, who have different styles of communicating. And I'm wondering if any of the issues that you write about in your book 9 to 5 have come into play in how you are misunderstood or misunderstood by the journalists who you talk with.
Yes, I'll tell you a serious one and a frivolous one. The frivolous one has come up twice now. I've approached a radio station and announced to the receptionist, I'm supposed to be on such and such a show. And twice now, the person I said it to, and in both cases they were men, said to me, well, are you gone or not? Don't you know? And both times I was kind of annoyed because obviously I had said something that was just a way of speaking. I didn't mean it literally. But I decided that I was just going to stop saying it that way because I don't like being put down by the answer. And so when I came in today, I said, I'm a guest on Fresh Air. That's the frivolous one because I don't think it had tremendous consequences. But I have learned in having interviews with journalists that it's not unusual at all for men journalists to take an approach that's somewhat provocative. In other words, they ask questions that are designed to kind of put my back up a bit, with the hope that that will get a more interesting response from me. And in the past, I would get really put off by that and would kind of dig in my heels and get ready for a really nasty article. And I've just learned that many people who do that are quite well-intentioned, and it's just their way of getting an interesting interview, and I just try to keep my cool and not be offended by it. At the same time, I've had to learn to be cautious of interviewers, and often this is women, who come on as my friend, are quite self-revealing about themselves in order to encourage me to be self-revealing and to talk in ways that are more unguarded. So I think these are two opposite and parallel ways of getting the subject to be unguarded. And I've learned that I have to not let my guard down in that sense and not say anything that I wouldn't feel comfortable seeing in print.
Linguist Deborah Tannen, her new book is called Talking from 9 to 5. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what's the latest from the Republicans?
Hi, Terry. Cheryl Duvall reports tonight on the Republican governor's meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia. They've been listening to the GOP leaders-to-be, Bob Dole in the Senate and Newt Gingrich in the House. And the governors are hearing promises that the states are going to be able to have more of a say in how things are run. Elizabeth Arnold reports on Senator Jesse Helms and his continuing attacks on President Clinton's performance. Senator Helms has said he regrets some of those remarks. Linda Wertheimer talks with three incoming members of Congress, and Dan Charles on the country's infrastructure problems, especially the bridges, and high-tech ways to find out what's wrong.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our TV critic David Bianculli looked over all the available things to review this week and settled on a series that premiered last month. It's part of a syndicated daytime series called The Fox Cub House. It's only seen on Mondays and Fridays, and it's aimed at preschoolers. But our critic says it hits him, too.
I figure I'm preaching to the converted here because I can't imagine any public radio listener who didn't love The Muppet Show. Well, of all the TV shows that have come out of Jim Henson Productions since then, the one I'm about to review is the very best. It was the last concept Henson was working on when he died, and his son Brian has picked up the ball and run with it. Even so, it bears his father's name in the title. The show is called Jim Henson's Animal Show with Stinky and Jake, and it's one of the most enjoyable shows I've seen all year. Imagine, if you will, a cross between The Muppet Show and Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. Jim Henson's Animal Show is like a talk show, except it's got animals instead of people. Well, not animals, really. Muppets. more realistic-looking Muppets than you've ever seen before, headed by the co-hosts, Stinky the high-strung skunk, and Jake, a laid-back polar bear.
Hello, all you little animals out there.
I am Stinky.
And I am Jake, and today we're going to meet two endangered species.
Wow, endangered species?
Stinky.
And when their guests come on and show clips, they're not film clips. They're scenes from nature documentaries, disguised as wildlife home movies.
You see, we rhinoceros, or rhinos as we're sometimes called, live out on the grasslands of Africa with lions, zebras, and lots of other animals.
Oh. Whoa, no wonder you're in danger. You're hanging around with lions.
Lions aren't the problem, Stinky.
No?
People are. Yeah, some people will hunt us, and some take away the land where we live.
Oh, and that's why there are so few rhinos left?
That's right. Although there's another one around here somewhere. Oh, there she is. Hi, Alice.
Oh, hi, Alice.
The nature footage comes from a production company called Survival Anglia, and Jake and Stinky keep it lively by adding funny voiceovers, asking goofy questions, or just having fun. Other segments in each show include a quiz, a musical number, and a cooking show segment on what animals eat. Think of the Swedish chef from The Muppet Show, except the cook in this particular kitchen is a Muppet cockroach, Yves St. LaRoche.
Bonjour, bonjour, all you food-loving animals out there. Now, today I want to talk about shellfish. Now, a shellfish is a fish that lives in a shell. Clever, no? Oui. Now, here we have the shellfish. But if you ask, how do we break the shell to get the fish? Well, do not worry, mon ami, because Yves will show you a trick he learned from his good friend, Plunk the Sea Otter. Now, the best way to crack a shellfish is with a small stone. Like so. And you go, whap, 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 whap.
I've not only learned to love this show, I've learned things about animals I didn't know before. The horn of a rhinoceros is made out of what? I thought ivory, but it's really made out of matted hair. And I heard it first on Stinky and Jake. Better late than never.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike, research assistants from Becky Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with filmmaker Ken Burns, the man behind the popular PBS series Baseball and the Civil War. And we meet Native American actress Tantu Cardinal. She grew up far away from stage and screen in the Canadian bush. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.